This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Lifetime Income on the Financial Sense News Hour. We're going to cover some topics related to retirement, and you're probably thinking, okay, you guys talk about retirement a lot, but what we're going to talk about today is things that can really mess up your retirement. I'm talking about very bad decisions that you could make right now if you're 5 or 10 years away from retirement, or actually during your retirement years, that can really cause some major problems. And then later on, we're going to talk about housing in the program, but Kathleen, you can tell them about that.
Well, later on in the program, Jim, I believe we'll be talking with Lewis Tenenbaum, and he's someone who does a lot of specialization in how to make your home livable for the remainder of your lifetime. He's part of an organization called the Aging in Place Institute, which is all about trying to keep people in their homes as long as possible. So he'll be talking a little bit about how to make sure that your home design is going to be friendly to you as you age.
Well, we'll be talking about housing because there's a lot of mistakes that you can make regarding housing, whether it's either taking a reverse mortgage in the wrong way when you may not need one, or taking it, spending money in a lump sum, and then you could be in trouble later on. But Kathleen, I want to move on to some of the big mistakes that we see people make when it comes to retirement. Number one at the top of the list is really mishandling their Social Security. There's a tendency with people that retire early to take benefits at age 62. But if you do that, you are only going to get about 80% of your full Social Security benefits. And also, if you work or have to work or supplement your income, you run the risk of having those benefits phase out. And guess what, folks? You're not going to be able to go back because you lose those benefits because you're working, but you're not going to be able to go back and start over again like if you were waiting to age 66. For most boomers out there that are listening to this broadcast, most boomers get full retirement benefits at age 66. And that age 66 is a key point because at age 66, not only do you get 100% of your Social Security benefits, but unlike in years past and actually over the last decade, you could actually work after age 66 and not forfeit any of your old Social Security benefits. Under the old rules, you would forfeit a larger amount between age 62 and 65. You would forfeit less amount between 65 and 70. And then after 70, when you had to begin mandatory distributions from your IRA, they didn't care if you worked. Well, they changed that law in the year 2000. So I would say one of the first big mistakes, Kathleen, that is often made by individuals is they get their benefits early and they find out they don't have enough income to live comfortably in retirement. So they end up going back to work. And because they took the benefits early, they end up starting to forfeit part of their Social Security benefit.
I'm thinking that would pretty much apply, especially to people who, let's say, end up living a lot longer than they thought they might. So if you're living longer into your 90s, let's say, and you ended up taking in a benefit early, you're getting a significantly lower Social Security check, which is going to count more and more as time goes on because inflation happens every year. And so by the time you're 90, you know, that difference in the Social Security payout could end up being a significant difference in your lifestyle, especially if you're long-lived. And Jim, I was thinking too, we've had a couple people on the program talk about Social Security and investigating your options. I think something else that clients do as well, especially now that we have so many dual income households out there now, that before either of you take your Social Security benefit, talk with the Social Security Administration about your various options in terms of who takes Social Security first and when, because it could affect your overall household Social Security level. So especially if you're a dual income family, make sure you check out the options if one of you takes the Social Security first and at what age, because it can make a big difference to your overall family household payout of Social Security.
And Kathleen, let me just throw out that website. It's socialsecurity.gov. There's a number of reasons you want to go there. Number one, you can find out what your accrued Social Security benefits. You may want to check that too for accuracy. So that's number one. Number two, they have a number of programs that you can go through and calculate, okay, what happens if I retire at age 62? What would my benefits be? What would my spouse's be? What if I wait to age 64, 65, 66? It really allows you to really kind of put some options forth and then try to figure out, okay, I would really be better off waiting to age 66 or maybe 65. Same with my spouse, or maybe both of you waiting to 66. Especially if you have some kind of retirement benefit. And that way, you're not going to have to make the mistake, because you really need to know this. Because once you pull the cord, once you take that option, you cannot reverse it. And they don't make it up. And so you really want to look at this very carefully, because this is probably one of the biggest mistakes that we see people make. And so once again, Social Security .gov is the first place that you're going to want to go and look at those options and take a look at the difference, not only just for yourself, but as Kathleen just mentioned, a lot of you today, you know, you're dual income households. So take a look at what happens if you delay taking yours, the difference it would make for your spouse's income, especially if, let's say, you have a wife that hasn't worked, where she's going to get 50% of yours. It can make a world of difference, not only for you, but also for your spouse as well. And that's very important, especially as Kathleen mentioned, more and more people are living longer. So that means those dollars have to take care of you over a lot more time than you're expected.
I'm just going to interject something here. I know we get a lot from our clients, which is we hear a lot of talk about the Social Security system being underfunded. So I've heard people say, well, I'm going to take my Social Security benefit now to get it while I can. Is there some validity to that thinking, Jim, or worried about Social Security means testing? What would you say to people who have those concerns?
I would say, Kathleen, probably right now there's not that worry. Longer term, they're going to have Social Security reform. And I think the easiest way to take care of some of the underfunded liabilities with Social Security has to do with the age. For example, in 1984, when Alan Greenspan headed up a commission, not only did they raise the taxes on Social Security, but over the years and in the 90s, they raised the Social Security age. So, for example, like boomers like myself, where full retirement age used to be 65 for full Social Security benefits, they have now moved that to age 66, and for the next generation to age 67. What I could see very likely happen, it was mentioned in the Simpson-Bowles plan, it was also mentioned in the Paul Ryan plan, is that they move full retirement benefits to age 69 and minimum benefits from age 62 to 65. That would go a long, long way to correcting some of the unfunded liability problems that we have in Social Security. So it's simply pushing back the timeline to reflect the fact that, let's face it, people are living longer today. When they started Social Security, a male lifespan was age 65. I think a woman was 68. Today, a woman's lifespan is in the 80s. A man's is in the 70s. So I think more likely, with disagreements between both parties, I think the compromise is going to be more likely on pushing back the age, because that has been the trend. Because, you know what, you're just not going to want to raise Social Security taxes. They're already raising them now with the cap, as each year your salary on which Social Security taxes are assessed. I mean, that's gone from, gosh, I can remember when it was $30,000. Today, it's about $110,000. So Social Security taxes are going up gradually with inflation. And I think that would be a very unpopular mandate, Kathleen, if they not only raise Social Security taxes, but then turned around and said, oh, by the way, if you retire and you have a lot of money, we're not going to give them to you. How popular do you think that's going to be with the working generation having their Social Security taxes raised and then told in the same time that they may not get it? I just don't think that would fly. So I think more likely is you're going to see a pushing out of the retirement date. I could see the minimum date going from 62 to 65 and the full benefit date going from 66 and 67 to age 69.
I was thinking too, Jim, I kind of get the impression that a lot of people view talking to Social Security Administration a lot like they would view, let's say, voluntarily picking up the phone and contacting the IRS. In other words, you know, something that you're not really looking forward to doing. And I think, you know, let's give the Social Security Administration some credibility here. Really, they're your best ally in trying to figure out the most effective and efficient way and financially beneficial way to maximize your Social Security benefit. So don't be afraid to pick up the phone or go to your local Social Security office or use the online tools. Because again, look at the Social Security Administration and their staff as your allies in trying to figure this out and not adversaries. So don't feel scared or worried about picking up the phone to make contact with them. Something else that I think we've seen some of our clients do or people we've heard about do is, you know, they hit retirement, they've got all this free time, they've got all this money they've saved for retirement, and they think to themselves, wow, now is the perfect time for me to get that boat and do all that sailing I've been meaning to do, or wow, now's the time to get that fantastic car.
Be careful there. Sailing is a very sensitive subject with me.
I wasn't pointing any fingers there, Jim. I was just saying.
Okay.
Or people, you know, they sign up to do really expensive hobbies that they didn't have time to do before. And the problem with that is, Jim, is that if you do a big ticket purchase, or let's say you do a home remodel and spend $25,000, $30,000, $40,000 on a home remodel when you first hit retirement, you're stripping your retirement savings at the very beginning of your retirement spending plan, meaning that for the rest of your retirement, that money isn't going to be there to generate extra income for you. So it can be a big problem that you get into retirement and the first thing you do is think, all right, time to spend some of this money.
Yeah, and we see that happen, Kathleen, in a number of ways. Remodel would be one. Buying the big expensive toys. I had a situation where a couple retired and they always wanted to get a bigger motorhome. So they spent close to $150,000 on a motorhome. And, you know, that was a big chunk. And of course, they weren't planning on the financial crisis that occurred between 2007 and 2009, nor were they planning on the drop in interest rates down to zero. And here was a big chunk of money tied up in a motorhome, and they only used it a couple times out of the year, and they've taken a big hit on it. And, you know, they would have been better off just getting in the car, traveling, driving around, staying in a hotel. It would have been a lot cheaper than making that big ticket item. So you really need to think if you're going to, you know, spend a couple $100,000 on a motorhome or a big sailboat, motor yacht, or a big remodel on the house, you really need to think about the consequences of that, because you're using up a lot of principal that could be generating income. And the reason that's important today, how many of you listening to this program right now would have ever thought that you would see one-year T-bill rates at around 0.3%, one-year treasuries at 0.1%, or a quarter or a half a percent at the bank, or the second bear market in less than 10 years, or the drop in housing? These were a lot of things that caught a lot of people by surprise, and they've wreaked havoc with a lot of people's retirement programs. So if you're going to splurge on a big ticket item, I would suggest not making another big mistake, which is our next topic, and not making a budget. And Kathleen, you have to deal a lot of that with our planning software when we're doing plans. So let's transition over to the budget, because this really fits into what we just talked about, those big ticket items.
Right, Jim. And I feel like we're always saying budget, budget, budget. And it's like this six-letter long bad word or something. It's something you say and people kind of cringe. You can almost hear it in their voices. I think this big ticket purchase is perfect, Jim, because when we're talking to people about financial planning and planning for retirement, if they have planned in to their plan a big ticket purchase at the time that they retire, and by the time they retire, they've saved enough money to meet that goal, I think doing a big ticket purchase is fine. I think the problem is when you haven't budgeted that into your plan, where it's a spontaneous spur of the moment decision, keep in mind that if you've done planning for your retirement and you haven't included these specific big ticket items, your financial plan, your total savings goal, is based on your budget. In other words, it's based on the basics, not these extra big ticket items. So again, budgeting and staying to the budget, staying to the plan are extremely important.
And not only staying on the plan and having a budget, Kathleen, but this relates to a guest that we're going to have on the show today, Tenenbaum, because he's talking about senior living and the new kind of housing developments that are starting to spring up as developers pick up on this aging baby boomer trend. And you got to think about that when you're thinking of a remodel. One of the smartest remodels, if you plan to stay in the house that you're living in now, is to make that house accommodative to aging. In other words, wider hallways, more free access around the kitchen, maybe an extra spare bedroom in case one of you becomes ill later on, needs nursing care. I mean, think about what would happen if one of you became incapacitated, had a stroke, dementia, had to get around in a wheelchair. Think about the difference that might make. And then especially think about, is it going to be practical if you have a two-bedroom house of climbing a flight of stairs? I'm trying to think of the name. It's a lift chair that they can have that they can attach on your stairway where you can get in the lift and it'll take you upstairs. But those are the kind of practical kind of things that you would want to do if you're going to do a remodel for retirement, and especially making grab rails in the bathroom around the bathtub, maybe a special bathtub that's easier to get in and out of. How many of you heard about an aunt, uncle, grandparent that has fallen, broken a hip, broken a leg? You know, grab rails around the bathroom are very, very important. So you got to think in the future. Think of not the way you feel now, the way things are going now. Think about what's going to happen to you in the future and what you may need in that house. Those are the kind of remodeling plans that make a lot more sense that you can put in and would make it very attractive if you want to stay in that house over a long period of time. But, you know, once again, Kathleen, it gets down to that topic we've been, oh gosh, how many times have we covered it on a program? Of making a budget. We've talked about the importance of having a retirement plan. Let's move on to what we call a non-financial plan. Let's explain that, because this is something that is not thought of and sometimes is, you know, you just don't think about it until you're retired. And then you go, oh my goodness, I want to do this. I want to do that. Or never thought of doing this. And now maybe you haven't budgeted for it.
Well, I think it's not just the budgeting, Jim. I think what happens is a lot of people, you know, they work their entire lives planning for retirement, and retirement sort of is the end goal. Once they get to the end goal, they don't have any plans for after the end goal. So really what you have to do is look at your retirement date as sort of a transition point between a pre-retirement lifestyle and a post-retirement lifestyle. So I think what a lot of people have been talking about these days is having an idea in your mind of what your life is going to be like after retirement. How are you going to fill your time? I have several clients who've actually gone back to work part-time in retirement because they just are going stir crazy. They just can't handle the amount of free time that they have. So I think the other thing is too, is that it's really good for you emotionally to make sure you have a good idea of what your post-retirement day is going to look like.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, all that time, and this is one reason we have often talked on the program, is maybe part-time work. You might find it invigorating. It's certainly good to keep yourself active, keep your brain working, because that's very important if you want to stay in good health. And also, sometimes by delaying or doing some part-time work, you can supplement the income and make your principal in the things that you have, the capital that you've accumulated, last over a longer period of time. And so, you know, think about part-time work or maybe some kind of other avocation. Maybe you did one thing for a living and you thought, gosh, you know, if I was to start my life over, I wish I could have done this. Well, maybe during retirement, that's the time to pursue something like that. You know, Kathleen, as we close here, a final topic I want to talk about that relates to our next guest, and that's moving, which relates to housing. So let's talk about some of the mistakes that are made in housing and talk about throwing your life into turmoil. Think of a move in retirement.
We've actually been, I won't say advocates, but we've certainly talked a lot on this program about the pros of moving in retirement. We've talked about the tax benefits of moving. We've talked about the budget benefits of moving to certain less expensive states. But I think that these are decisions that should be carefully considered, especially if you're moving, let's just say, far away from family. I know a lot of people would really find it very difficult, no matter what the financial benefit was, to move a significant distance away from their grandkids, for example. That's a pretty significant life change. Or if the things that you like to do, your hobbies, aren't as readily available in your new state, again, it's about having that time really hang heavy on your hands in retirement. So before you make a move, again, really do some thinking and some homework about, you know, what will my lifestyle, what will my life really look like in this new location? And will I really be happy there? Maybe you test drive it. Maybe you and your spouse go out there for a couple months at a time just to check it out, make sure you're happy with the climate, with the things to do. But certainly before you pull up roots, a little bit of test driving is not a bad idea.
So in conclusion, as we talk about some of the five ways you can really mess up your retirement, at the top of the list, we talked about mishandling Social Security. And I really would strongly urge you to go to the Social Security site, that's socialsecurity.gov. Find out what your benefits are. Find out what those benefits will be at age 62, all the way up to full retirement at age 66. That is a big one, folks. And remember, once you make that decision, you can't reverse it. So spend a little time looking into that. Secondly, we talked about splurging on big ticket items. Really think twice before you do that, because that relates to the third item, which is coming up with a budget. I can't tell you how important that is. It'll save you from wreaking havoc with your retirement. And then, as Kathleen talked about, you know, what are you going to do with all that free time? Maybe you would be better off delaying retirement, maybe working part-time, and find out what are those hobbies that you're most interested in, and how are you going to spend all that free time? And then finally, we talked about moving, which leads us up to my special guest today, as we talk about retirement housing, the lifestyle. Builders are responding, and what they're doing is they're creating whole new housing in retirement communities. They're doing a real big one up here in California, up in Irvine, where they're going to have five developments. Two of them are going to be for seniors, totally different makeup inside the house. There'll be single story, wider hallways, extra guest bedrooms, even an extra den or study, different kitchens, easier to get around, grab rails in bathrooms. And those are the things that you need to think about. But that's coming up next. And Kathleen?
Let's just talk about this whole idea of, where do you live in retirement? We've talked about moving locations, but what about the actual living space that you're in? I think that most of us, Jim, have an idea of our minds of being able to live at home as long as possible. I think very few of us are super excited about going into a nursing facility or a long-term care facility, for example, although there are a lot of really attractive retirement communities now. But I think for a lot of us, this whole idea of aging at home and staying at home as long as possible is really the way that we imagine approaching the end of life, right? But I also think, like you were mentioning, Jim, we have this huge population out there that's going to start having these specific housing needs. So I think it's really smart that builders out there are starting to really gear their building strategies toward this growing part of the population, and the population especially that's looking for new places to live. Before we wrap things up today, I just want to give a nod to the inspiration for this particular podcast, which came from an article in the Wall Street Journal by Brett Arends called Five Ways You Can Really Mess Up Your Retirement. So coming up next, Jim's going to be talking with Lewis Tannenbaum about different ways to think about managing space and housing in retirement.
Joining me as my special guest this week on Lifetime Income is Lewis Tannenbaum. He's founder of Aging in Place Institute. And Lewis, tell our listeners a little bit about your background. You're a former carpenter and contractor, just to sort of set the stage of what we want to talk about.
Sure. I'm a carpenter. I originally became a carpenter after finishing college because I wanted to build my own solar house. I moved to the D.C. area and was working as a carpenter contractor. When approached in 1988 about a project for a young man who was about to emerge from rehab, paraplegic after a tragic gunshot accident. And I asked his mom what they needed a carpenter for. And she said, well, he was independent before he was injured, and I want him to be independent in the bathroom when he comes out. And this was a novelty to me and a real source of inspiration. There wasn't an internet. There was no way to find information. But I did what I could and built him a bathroom, probably different than I would today, that he was able to be independent in that bathroom when he came home. And it thrilled his mom. It made their family whole again. And it thrilled me to have such a significant impact with my tools on this family. A few years later, I read an article about the age wave and said, wow, there's an opportunity there. I can help people who are older, who've maybe had an illness or an accident or something, prepare their homes so they can be independent. And it'll thrill me again. So I started to carve out that niche. And by the mid to late 90s, I was teaching around the country on this subject and consulting for the Administration on Aging and AARP and groups like that about aging in place remodeling and design issues. but still always with the question in the back of my mind of, if this is such a good idea, if people are able to grasp it so readily and easily, why doesn't anyone really call? Why isn't there much business? Eventually, through some work with the National Endowment for the Arts and a collaboration among AARP and the National Association of Home Builders, we built a program called CAPS, Certified Aging in Place Specialist. And it's been the most successful educational program of NAHB's history, but still leaves us with the question, why, if this is such a good idea, aren't people remodeling their homes in time? And it led me to write a paper for MetLife a few years ago called Aging in Place 2.0. And 2.0 is kind of like, what would the next generation of aging in place look like? And that's where I am and why I started the Aging in Place Institute, to approach two questions identified in that MetLife paper. One was, how do we motivate clients to do this kind of preparation? Not much different than the financial planning we're trying to get people to do, but a little more concrete in every respect. And second of all, how can we get businesses to work systematically to care for people in their homes, which is where they want to be? And that's where I am now. So to start off, just one of the real problems is this. Most people wait for a crisis. If you wait for a crisis to remodel your home, it's really hard to get it done because there's a lot of decisions to be made. There are people to hire. There are choices to make. There are permits to get. There are drawings to be done. And when you're having a health crisis, it's not a good time to remodel your home. Kind of like insurance. You can't buy insurance when you need it. You have to buy it hoping you'll never need it. So this is a little better than insurance, because if we do a beautiful job of renovating your home to make it what you want, to make it spa-like, but also make it a place where you can remain even if health problems emerge, or more importantly, to help avoid certain health problems like falls, then you get good value from that insurance, even if you never actually have to make a claim.
Lewis, let's talk about some of the things that people don't think about. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned this, because I've interviewed somebody in real estate in Orange County. They're starting a new development, and part of that development is going to be homes for seniors that are going to be a little bit different. I mean, I suspect it would be a single story. I don't think a three-story condo would work. Let's talk about things like bathrooms, grab rails, wider doorways in case somebody has, let's say, a wheelchair, or I would think a spare bedroom, where if somebody became ill, if you had to have in-home care. Let's talk about some of those things that you might incorporate.
Well, you've mentioned them, but let's start out with a basic assumption that you made, which is a common and reasonable assumption that multiple levels is probably not a good idea. But the fact is, we build in more multiple levels nowadays because land is expensive and foundations are expensive and roofs are expensive. But the space of an elevator, which has kind of come down relatively in cost, is not that expensive compared to a larger lot. The other advantage of an elevator, a well-positioned elevator with a wide enough door and maneuvering space, just like all the other rooms, the advantage of a well-positioned elevator is you only have to be in it for a few moments to go from one space to another. So whereas one-floor homes often mean long corridors that you have to traverse, an elevator could mean that you go from, you know, the elevator, which is located next to your bedroom on one floor and next to your entertainment area, your relaxing area on another floor, very quickly with only a few minutes between them.
Lewis, let me stop you there for a minute. Aren't elevators expensive to put in an existing structure?
In an existing structure, elevators are sometimes expensive. But the machines don't cost that much. It's the associated remodeling and development. You've really hit on it. The basic question is this. If you have a multiple-story house, there's three ways to go. So now we're going to remodeling, because you started out asking about new and talking about a new development and your suggestion that one floor. But if you start thinking about remodeling, many homes are multiple stories. So here's the choices. You can add space on the first floor. Now that means you have to have a lot that's large enough and your neighborhood has to be able to support more house. The second choice is to reuse, repurpose rooms on the main floor. And, of course, the oldest story we know on this is where a side porch was converted into a bedroom and a corner of the dining room is converted to a full bath or something like that. That's not a bad strategy. It can be converted back by the next owner, so you don't really lose much value. And the third strategy is to get to the second floor where the bedroom and bathroom is. And that could sometimes be a stair glide, you know, one of those chairs by the stairs, or better, I think, is an elevator. So the cost of installing that elevator might be $45,000. Let's take a round number that's a little high. $20,000 or $25,000 for the equipment and $20,000 to build the shaft and paint everything and get it all set up. Now, if you compare that to what's the competition for this kind of thing, aging in place, you get to an assisted living situation, which is probably going to make that 1 year's worth of assisted living. Of course, the elevator isn't going to solve all your problems. You may still need help with bathing and so forth. You may still need help with transportation issues. You may still need someone to bring in some food and so forth. But you can now consider that elevator a capital investment that lasts for a couple years for you or 10, but also continues to create value for your home and the next occupant. So the things you've mentioned originally, wider doors, and I typically say maneuvering space as well as wider doors, because you can go down an alley in your car, and if the alley is the width of your car and the garage is the width of your car, you still can't make that turn. You need maneuvering space. So the key things are maneuvering space, safety lighting, because it's important that you have good lighting that doesn't cast shadows and doesn't cause glare that you can maneuver around in. Lever door handles are good because sometimes it's really hard to grip a round knob, particularly if your hands are, like mine, a bit arthritic. A safe bathroom that can really be operated in, as you say, with a walker or a wheelchair. But more important, I think of this as a three-legged race, like we used to do at a picnic. You need to get through those doorways and into that bathroom with a helper. And you need to be safe, and the helper needs to be safe. So just like a three-legged race, you're tied together at the hip, and if one of you goes down in the mud, you both go down.
You know, I just keep thinking of kitchens today have like center counters. So I suspect a kitchen that is wide open, so if you're in a wheelchair, you can get around. We talked about doorways. Also, Lewis, talk about things like grab rails in bathrooms next to, let's say, showers and toilets, things like that.
We don't usually say confined to a wheelchair, because you're not confined to your car when you use it. But you use your car, and some people use a wheelchair, right? And some people use a wheelchair just to help them with stamina. It's not the only way they get around. The other thing is that wheelchair use is often short. It's following an injury or an illness or an operation, and you rehab and use a wheelchair, and then you emerge from that wheelchair. So the idea of grab rails is, you know, when you're in a hotel room with a grab bar, and I did this when I was younger, my kids, there was no stigma to them using it. So the same sort of thing here. A grab rail can be an insurance policy that helps you remain steady when you're getting in and out of the bathtub, or it can be something you need more definitely later on. I prefer to put them in advance. So when I do a bathroom, I don't put in any towel bars. Everything is a grab rail. Everything is something that can hold me sturdily when I reach for it in that wet, hard space of the bathroom. And when I do grab rails, I don't just put it across the tub, because if you think of the grab rail you see in most hotel rooms, which is one along the long wall of the tub, you have to lean way over to reach that. And it's behind you when you're climbing out. So I try to have a vertical rod, one straight up and down, near the entrance to the tub that I hold with one hand when entering and probably with the other hand when exiting, so that as I lift my leg, I've just got something strong and secure to hold on to.
Lewis, what about extra bedrooms? Sometimes you will find as couples age, one may get temporarily sick or maybe permanently sick where they need to be put in a special bedroom, and also where you may have to have, let's say, hospice or full-time in-house care or part-time care. Let's talk about extra rooms and their importance.
First of all, as I've gotten older, and this probably happens for others too, I don't sleep quite as well. So it's not uncommon for even couples to start using separate bedrooms, sometimes even separate bathrooms. You know, your house is less fully occupied. Many homes that had five bedrooms, you know, three kids and two adults, now they have two occupants, 20% occupancy of what there was before. So people find it's just a little more comfortable sometimes to use more than one bedroom for a couple. But also this idea of a caregiver living with you, whether it's a family member who's living with you short or long term, or sometimes, as you are suggesting, there's a paid caregiver who may want to live there because they're putting in long hours, or it's more convenient than traveling back and forth, or in fact, there's a lot of shared housing type things going on where two or more adults are deciding to share a home because there are advantages to having somebody around, and there are advantages socially and financially. There's also situations where, let's say, a young student who can't afford that neighborhood is able to live in a home with an older person, again, financial and social advantages. So there's a lot of reasons that the household that we picture, kind of this ending nuclear household, is starting to break down. There's a lot of different experiments, cooperative housing, communal housing of different kinds going on in all different ways. So that maybe if you did have, you know, let's take the ideal situation, you have a student nurse who gets to live in a nicer neighborhood with an older client, and the symbiosis of that, the nurse gets a nicer neighborhood, but also is available to just know that the other person got out of bed that day and that they made something to eat and to check in with family members. And for the older person, they have company, but not company all the time because, you know, a lot of us don't really want to go back to the dorm, but that doesn't mean that we don't want to be near other people.
Lewis, what about furniture? I had an instance where an older client fell out of bed and hit their head on furniture. I mean, I would think not only have we been talking about space and maneuverability, but what also about furniture? Like, for example, chairs that are easier to get in and out of?
Right. Well, one of the key rules when you start to have any sort of problems with strength, stamina, balance, things like that, is that you have a chair that you're able to get your feet kind of under you so that your knees are above your toes when you're standing up. So you want a chair that's sturdy, that has arms that you can push off on, but also that doesn't have a little skirt below, because that sometimes keeps you from getting your feet back as far as you want them under your knees before you stand up. I was also visiting with a client the other day, and he was complaining about his office chair, and quite reasonably, because these five-wheel office chairs that we have now are really good for rolling around on, and you don't fall over from them. But what happens is, if you really need to push off on them, they often disappear on you. They roll away as you're trying to stand up. And we were trying to brainstorm some solutions, and the solution we actually came up with is that the chair should be very sturdy and solid, and the desk should move. He should be able to push his desk away from him so that he has room to stand up and maneuver in front of his chair, and then pull his desk back to him and pull it up tight to his tummy without having to do that maneuver. You know, so we have the maneuver of this roly-roly chair is one way, and the other is that you have a chair that doesn't move, and then you have to do the pick-up, shuffle, which he can't do either. So a chair both that has good arms, that is sturdy, that isn't too far down or too far deep, has a place where you can get your feet back under so your knees are over your toes when you try to stand up, and that doesn't move around on you. That's the idea.
And I guess maybe some final things. You know, we all heard about these alert buttons that alert 911, an ambulance. What about something like that that is internal? Say, for example, somebody falls or has, you know, let's take a worst case situation. They're having a heart attack or something like that where there's some kind of button or something that can not only ring somebody internally in the home, but also, let's say, somebody externally for help.
It really started out with the kind of pull cord that they put next to the toilet. And the problem with that, of course, is that you had to be cognizant and be able to reach that pull cord when you had a problem. Then it became the PERS, Personal Emergency Response System, and that's the one that we are familiar with on television. I've fallen, I can't get up, and probably Philips Lifeline is the biggest provider of that button. And again, you need to be wearing it, you need to be conscious, you need to be cognizant, and that button not only works locally, but typically dials a telephone to a call center with a very high-quality speakerphone, so that even if you're a room or so away, you can answer some questions about what sort of help you need after you've pressed the button. Now things are moving even farther forward. One of the types of things is, I don't know if you're familiar with an iPhone or phones like that, you know, when you turn the phone, it changes the picture. It recognizes right away that you've turned it. So there are devices now, kind of like phones, that you can use that kind of gyrometer or whatever it is on your belt, and it can tell when you have moved from vertical to horizontal very quickly. And if you've moved from vertical to horizontal very quickly, you may have fallen, and it will dial that speakerphone and ask you, do you need some help getting up? And if you don't answer, then they call the ambulance for you. And now these things were phones, and now they're also becoming GPS cell phone based. So you can be out walking down the street and fall down. It might detect that you've fallen, ask you a question through the speakerphone on that phone on your belt, and because it's GPS, it can send the ambulance right to you if you don't answer.
I was recently talking to somebody in the real estate, and they were talking about new developments that they're putting in where they design these planned communities, and they're having certain sections that are more applicable to, let's say, senior living that may have some of the features that you had in the main house before you sold it. It may have, in addition to a guest room, a nice master bedroom, or even a study. Do you see projects like that? We've started them in Orange County. Are you starting to see that across the country now?
There was a big sort of market for what was called active adult 50-plus housing that started with Del Webb outside Phoenix in Sun City in 1964, I think, or 1960, and moved up and became quite a big part of the building business. It kind of took a real serious hit with the recent recession, but I've seen a lot of evidence that it's reemerging. But hopefully it will reemerge in a more sophisticated way. And by that, I mean, first of all, right, it is often part of planned unit development, so that the important factors to these older people, which are transportation, ease to get to good hospitals, ease to get to good shopping, and places to go. So there are kind of three things. You need ways to get around and places to go, right? And the housing needs to be affordable and appropriate. So this is when we are talking about these factors that make a home a good candidate for aging in place, for example, that include a no-step entry, at least one entry you can get into without using steps, that include the ability, as we talked about, to get to a bedroom and bathroom without using steps, and that is space appropriate so you can move around well. It has grips and grab bars, good, easy controls like lever handles on the faucet and grip rails throughout. And a kitchen, as you say, that has possibly multiple height work surfaces, maybe a place where you can sit down while you're cooking, because why do you have to get sore feet standing up just because you want to cook something? And maybe a multiple height work surface, a lower surface helps your grandchildren or children visit, or a seated user work in the kitchen. But we take it even another step, and we say we want this type of appropriate housing, but we don't want to build it and make ghettos, make neighborhoods that are specifically age-specific only. We want, in fact, this sort of housing to be available throughout the development. But you can't know who is, one, going to buy which house, or two, how long they're going to stay there. So we go all the way and say these ideas called universal design should be in every house in every development, because the people who move in when they're 40 may still be there when they're 80. The people who move in when they're 33 and sell when they're 42 may find a buyer who's 70 who will stay there when they're 80. So in fact, the really progressive way to do it is just make every house a really good house for whoever moves in. What if, like my first client, the young man, child living in that house has an accident and wants to stay there? What if the dad has a work-related accident and the family wants to stay in that house? What if grandma has a stroke and wants to come visit? If the house is designed well, it's going to work for everyone. There's no downside to universal design.
Lewis, as we conclude, if you had to do just one or two, maybe three improvements to a home to make it more senior friendly, what would they be?
The first would be to look for a no-step entry, whether it's from the garage, from the front, or even from the back or some other place. I've done homes where I took out a window into a room and changed it to a door and a side light so that we could get a no-step entry off the deck, for example, around the back. The second would be being able to get through that house, a maneuvering path that gets you to a full bathroom and bedroom without using stairs, well lit and with appropriate turning spaces. And the third would be to make that bathroom a safe zone, no matter who's using it. Because that bathtub I described with a grab bar vertically on the side is a great one for a young girl whose hair is in her face, and she's thinking fast about getting to a date that night or out to a party, and it's easy for that person to misstep, just as it is for a person who may be taking more time but has more difficulty stepping. So I would make a bathroom, maybe with a curbless shower, with grab bars throughout, nothing that you can grab that you can't reach, and that hopefully has space for two people to maneuver together. Those are the three things: the no-step entry, a path to a full bathroom and bedroom with no steps, and a safe and maneuvering space available bathroom.
Well, Lewis, as we close, why don't you tell our listeners about the site that you have and how they can get more information about there and what they'll find?
Well, my site, lewistenenbaum.com, is primarily focused on providers, businesses that are looking at this market. There are lots of good sites about universal design, and you can get direction to them from my site. But my site is primarily focused on the business people who are looking at this market and want to do a good job of doing well by doing good and serving this growing population of older people, because businesses need to be savvy about older consumers and how they work together to create a full network of business opportunity for consumers.
We've been talking with Lewis Tenenbaum. Lewis, I want to thank you for coming on the program. That was a lot of good, useful information.
That was a real pleasure. I enjoyed my topic. I love my work.
Well, that concludes our interview. It's amazing how the marketplace is adapting to an older population. After all, we've got the largest baby boomer population in this country that is now aging and moving into retirement, as Lewis was talking about. Your needs for living are much different as you age, and especially in retirement, where oftentimes you can run into illness, some incapacities or disabilities. And it's good to see the marketplace respond. As I've done previous interviews, we're seeing some new housing developments reflect some of the things that Lewis and I talked about. Well, that concludes today's show. On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. We have a couple special programs that we're going to be playing during our August recess. They are the most widely listened to programs we've ever done on this show. One of them you're going to want to listen if you missed out earlier. It's How to Protect a Surviving Spouse. We got more hits on this program than anything I think we've ever done in the last year. You're going to want to listen to it if this has been on your mind, or let's say you're a woman, you're thinking about, wait a minute, my husband makes all the financial decisions, He's older than I am, and what happens if something happens to him? How am I set up? You're going to really want to listen to this. So we have a lot of great programs that we're going to play the best of over the next 2 weeks, over the last 15 months since we started this program. They've been the most popular, voted by you, our listeners. So that's coming up in the next weeks ahead. Meanwhile, until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant rest of the week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.